thank you everyone for coming. As I mentioned a moment ago, this is Explaining the World Through Science Comics, so I'm stoked that I have the opportunity to talk about two of my favorite things that are actually better in conjunction, science and comics. So before we get started, I just wanted to make sure that I thanked TCAF, and TCAF would like to thank their sponsors. Programming is sponsored by the Seneca College's Faculty of Communication, Art, and Design. TCAF would also like to thank our presenting sponsors, The Beguiling, Little Island Comics, and the Toronto Public Library. And their media sponsor is Now Magazine. They'd also like to recognize the Canada Council for the Arts, the Ontario Arts Council, and the Toronto Arts Council. And before we begin, one other thing I'd like to mention is that the Toronto Comic Arts Festival is on the land that is the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, Mississaugas of the New Credit First Nation, the Haudenosaunee, and the Huron-Wendat that Indigenous peoples have lived on. They've lived here and cared for this land for more than 15,000 years. TCAF would like to acknowledge that this territory is covered by the Dish With One Spoon Wampum Belt Treaty. And today, Toronto is still the home to many Indigenous peoples from across Turtle Island. We'd like to acknowledge that settlers on this land have directly benefited from the process of colonialization. And in recognition of that we are gathering on these lands for TCAF 2019, the festival has made a donation to the Gord Downey and Cheney Wenjack Fund. We look forward to increasing our support and programs for Indigenous creators in the future. So, with that, I would like to also thank our lovely panelists for coming to join us today. To my left here is Lillian Melcher, who joins us from Boston, Massachusetts, and studied at Parsons School of Design. She's here promoting her debut work, which is the illustrated history of Alexander von Humboldt. And congratulations on your debut work.
Thank you very much.
Would you like to introduce your name, your pronouns, your table name?
Yes. So I do not have a table, but my book is available at the Penguin Random House table. My pronouns are she, her, and my name is Lillian Melcher.
Great. And Lillian, I want to ask a lightning round question so people can start to get to know you.
Yes.
What are you nerding out about lately?
Especially on Twitter, I've been seeing a lot of videos of alpacas taking care of the little alpaca in their herd. So they all kind of like come together and take care of them together. And that's my thing right now.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah. It's good. Look it up.
All right. And Jeremy joins us, Jeremy Boyer, joins us all the way from Paris. He's published a number of graphic novels, including La Traversée, which is a post-apocalyptic work, Yesterday, which was about the assassination of John Lennon.
Yes.
And other things. but most relevant, he's recently published two graphic novels. One is Audubon, On the Wings of the World, which is about a naturalist who was very interested in studying birds. And at TCAF, you're debuting Darwin, An Exceptional Voyage, which is about the journey of young Charles Darwin. Yeah.
Yes, that's right. I'm in the stand of Nobro, and I'm glad to be here. You already told what I would.
Yeah.
My pronouns are he, his, mm-hmm. and... My nerdism.
Yeah.
I can say Fortnite, for sure.
Fortnite, yes,
no,
that's
no,
good.
No. I'm looking for a book about spiders because this summer I'm gonna keep a house in the middle of forest, and I want to study spiders around the... So I try to find the best book about spiders. So okay.
It's very good to have a very clear reference with good pictures of what just bit me, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Right in front of your mouth.
Oh, yeah.
Awesome.
Is this good?
Yeah.
Cool.
Okay. And finally, Ryan North is here with us as well. Ryan did his undergrad in computer science and his master's of science at U of T in computational linguistics.
Yes.
He is the creator of Dinosaur Comics, which is still ongoing and has been running for...
Over 15 years.
He co-created the Machine of Death series, which is an anthology of science fiction stories. He created the To Be or Not To Be Choosable Path adventure stories. He's gotten Eisner nominations for Adventure Time, Squirrel Girl, and Jughead.
We won those.
Oh, did you win them all?
Yes.
Eisner Award winning.
Yes.
And, most importantly, is the co-author, the translator of a book that was found. I don't know what your preference is and how you like to explain this.
So it's called How to Invent Everything, A Survival Guide for the Stranded Time Traveler. And it's nonfiction wrapped in this fictional candy coating. And as part of that fiction, I didn't write the book. I discovered it, encased in solid granite, by an author from the year 2064 who shares my name.
Weird.
So I built a fiction in which I plagiarized an alternate universe version of myself.
Where are you tabling?
All right. I'm tabling on the second floor in the atrium. Look for the nice, shiny, sunshiny part. You'll find me there. Use he, him pronouns, and well, the other science thing is, I write Squirrel Girl for Marvel, and she's a computer scientist, so I get to use my otherwise not often used computational linguistics degree to write a book about a talking squirrel, and it pays off.
The world is topsy-turvy.
Just full of surprises.
And what are you nerding out about lately?
You guys have way better answers than me. I like Star Trek.
Yeah.
But I thought of a better one. My dog has got a lot of ticks on him lately, and so I've been reading up on these, you know, blood parasites that attach to your body and then suck up plasma and make their butts giant as they fill with it. And it's gross. They're really gross. And the first time I pulled that tick off my dog, I didn't realize what it was. I thought it was like a skin tag or something. And then my wife pulled it off, and it has this spider legs at the front. So I started crawling around, and when you're not expecting a spider, suddenly you have a spider, it's quite a thrill.
So
they're disgusting.
The insects are top of mind for the majority of our panelists today.
But also Star Trek.
And Star Trek. Yeah. Disco, thumbs up, thumbs down.
Do we want to start a controversial note?
All right. That's a different
we're recording
panel.
This.
Yeah. So just to wrap things up, my name is Jem, and pronouns are they, them. And I'm your moderator today. So I wanted to dive right in and talk a little bit about the works that you've recently completed. So starting with Lillian, you created an incredible biography with your co-author, right?
Yes.
About Alexander von Humboldt, who is a naturalist scientist from the 18th century?
He started the journey that we're talking about in 1799 and it went till 1804. He's pretty much the first person to talk about climate change the way we do today, and he was the first to collect data points that we use today to prove that climate change is happening.
Yeah.
He's super important, but a majority of North America has forgotten him a lot.
Yeah. So can you describe a little bit? He seems like an incredible, larger-than-life figure. What types of challenges did you encounter in bringing that down to something approachable and accessible?
Yeah, well, we had a lot of help from Humboldt himself, actually, because we were using, in 2014, his manuscripts were made public. We had the transcriptions of them, so we had all the words, but the sort of layout of them and the amount of drawings that were in them wasn't really known to the public before 2014. So Andrea, my co-author, who's Humboldt's biographer, she wrote an amazing book called The Invention of Nature, that if you want to know more about Humboldt, that's where to go. But you can read these manuscripts and you get so much character out of them because he leaves things out, he goes really into little instances that you would think, oh, why is he caring so much about that? But it's because he's caring about the people that are involved or the thing that he's, like, really nerding out about. Like, oh, I'm going to talk for an entire page about this leaf. So I then have to respect his nerding out about this leaf and, like, give it an entire page. So it was sort of like a conversation with, an ed guy.
Yeah.
It was really nice.
Interesting. Jeremy, did you encounter something similar? Was there just so much information and you had to decide what to focus on?
We have to decide. I am the drawer of the book, Fabien Grolot, who is a co-author, to write the story. We based on the journal of Darwin, who traveled around the world for 5 years when he was young. He was 22 years old. And we just wanted to tell a story, not really a biography about Darwin, just based on the book, on his journals. So we didn't get so much precision. We don't have to do that because it's a graphic novel or some kind. We want to entertain the readers, so, but we have to be careful about we said about Darwin's and yeah.
So you're coloring your interpretation, right? You have to be careful about what you're adding.
Yeah, for sure. And we have to be careful about also dates and time where we travel. So. We put some, for entertain, we put some romance in the book, but I don't think it happened there.
Yeah. Ryan, your book is about literally everything. I'm really curious where you decided to even start.
I started just by doing a bunch of research, just reading, and after about 6 months of that, I started to feel kind of vaguely anxious that I had not written anything yet, and that the book might not be possible, because the idea of a book is collapsing civilization into, 400 or so pages. I want it to be a book you read for fun, but also a book that would be a sincere and practical answer to how can you rebuild civilization alone while stranded in the past. And I wasn't sure it was possible. So I wrote about 50,000 words just to test it out until I realized, oh, wait, that there is a book here and there is enough low-hanging fruit in civilization that you can build a viable technological civilization in the past.
How much time did you spend on the pure research phase before you were like, oh, I gotta make a call here?
Oh gosh, I felt like the pure research phase never really stopped. I started writing about 8 months into it,
okay.
I think. But that was mostly figuring out the fiction around it, bringing up this world in which time machines are rented out to members of the public willy-nilly, which seems wildly irresponsible. And maybe they're rental time machines, so they break down, so you need this book. This book's written by a corporation, doesn't expect you to read it. So all like the fiction was the easy part. And then I just had to fill in the nonfiction parts, the real parts.
Yeah.
And that's the thing, I'd never written nonfiction before. And with nonfiction, you can be wrong. In fiction, it's your characters who are wrong, and you're a great writer for writing such flawed characters. It's a whole new challenge.
Yeah, and I'm sure that was a challenge for everyone. Did you encounter something where you got a detail that you really wanted to portray it one way, but it would be factually inaccurate?
I mean, I had one in the book where I wanted, because I'm doing how to purify water, and I have charcoal filters, and I have boiling it, because you know what a germ is now. But I wanted to do chlorinated water because they give you instructions how to make chlorine for other purposes. It's dangerous. Mm. It's a disclaimer in the book saying this will kill you if you try it, but you'll be really cool doing it. And it turns out the amount of chlorine in water that makes it safe to drink is a very small window between ineffective and poisonous. And I couldn't come up with a way that you could actually do that in the past and not put everyone at risk. So I had a fight with the facts. They were like, no, there's no way I can put this in the book.
I think that's very responsible.
A responsible guy. Responsible time traveler.
Yeah. Did you encounter that, Jeremy?
Not so much, because Fabien does the most write of the book. I'm just the hand. So sometimes, for Audubon, the book before Darwin, we put a lot of things really important, but the rest of the book is really non-fiction.
Fictionalized.
Yeah. I feel like I couldn't really get away with anything, but sort of where I got to play was in the characterization of these people, which I pulled from a source, but also me and Andrea worked very closely writing the whole thing. I mean, she wrote it. And then I would come in and say, you know, I want Bonpland and Humboldt to be closer friends, and I want them to have a few more tender moments together, and I want, you know, maybe there's like a joke here, you know, and this is something that a nonfiction writer doesn't really think about, you know, mm-hmm. How do we make a visual story not just like a biography that's very, this happened and then that happened. It's like, well, maybe this happened, but they're humans, they're probably... There's conversations being had, you know? So that's sort of... putting more of that in was my constant fight.
And do you think that's essential in making an otherwise historical work, a biographical work, making it more engaging and accessible?
I think it's important for making it engaging, but I also think it's realistic. You know, if these people are working together for 4 years, you know, you can't really... say in a biography, they were also friends, you know? That's like the extent of it. But by showing people the relationship instead of just writing about the relationship, you can really sort of have fun with it. And even if it is a little bit invented, it's based on recorded fact. It's based on their diaries or their writing. And, you know, it's just a way to make these people characters. And if you make scientists characters, you can sort of better understand what they're trying to teach you, I think, personally.
Jeremy, was that an influence in creating the romance in Darwin's story? Or expanding on the romance?
Like she said, we have to compare to the character. You have to put into the character. So it's important to put emotion or some kind of sensitive, because we talk about science, all right, but it's a character, and it's about a biographic, historical character, so that, ça veut pas dire qu'ils n'ont pas de vie.
It's lifeless otherwise,
so... it's important to put emotion in the story, and the part of the scientific is almost in my book, in Darwin, it's almost anecdotic.
Like a footnote.
Yeah.
And Ryan, there's no characters at all in How to Invent Everything, only kind of like the hypothetical reader.
Yeah, which made it easy.
Good. But you did add a lot of humor into that book.
Yeah, well, the structure of having it being written like it's a time travel repair manual, where the first page says, you know, there's no user serviceable parts inside, you're stuck. The rest of this guide is an appendix on how to rebuild civilization. That fiction that you're wrapped in gave me a chance to break up the nonfiction parts. I don't care if I put in jokes. I sort of like... let's take a breath and relax before we have to build, you know, a working computational engine out of water and sticks.
Yeah. No, it definitely was like, I got the vibe that some bored person at a corporation was like, oh, let's just fill this in because my boss needs to see it, which made it very fun.
Thank you.
I wanted to go back to Jeremy, and you mentioned Audubon, the book that you had before, Darwin, and... Audubon speaks of birds as captivating him from a very young age, and almost like a scientific first love. Did you have a scientific first love?
Oh, maybe, yes, insect. When I was young, my father bring me to climb for mountain or to hike. And almost all the time when I was in the forest, I just stay in the forest and looking for some insect or what I find. And,
So very much nature.
Yeah, very much.
Was it the same for you, Ryan, or was it more tech?
Yeah, tech for sure, big nerd. I would read tons of science fiction, like hard science fiction, but like accessible for a 12-year-old hard science fiction, which might not have been that good for me, because I read a lot of stories where, you know, 50s sci-fi, it's like a lot of them, the characters are very thin, there's no women, and it's just about two smart male scientists in a room discussing a problem with each other. And I was like, this is catnip for me, give me more of this. And then when I first started writing, I'm like, how do you write characters? Like, I'm not used to stories with actual characters, but I'm just used to, like, two scientists in a room discussing things with each other. Which I guess you can kind of see in dinosaur comics, where two dinosaurs talking to each other. Sorry, what was the question?
What was your first scientific love?
First scientific love. I don't even know. All sorts of stuff. My dad is an electrical engineer, so he would show me stuff. He made a working digital clock from the 60s. He gave me that. There was a short in it, and it electrocuted me.
Oh, no.
It had decayed since the 60s. He had a bunch of, like, cool electronic stuff in the basement, so I would play with solder and get, like, burns on my fingers. And I guess sort of maybe by How to Make Everything being a generalist book, I just sort of liked everything. A little bit dabbling, dilettante, you know?
Yeah, fair enough. Lillian, did you have a scientific first love?
There's, like, two things that stand out to me. Book-wise, I come from a very heavy fantasy background, so nothing there. But when I was really young, me and my mom made a camera obscura, like the Dutch masters used to use for my science fair. And I was like, this is how I incorporate art into everything I do. and also, my dad would take me to the aquarium all the time. And I think, like Humboldt, I was so into the electric eel. I was, like, terrified of it, but I was also like, I need to know more. And in Boston, the electric eel is in this tank that has this measurement stick from, I swear, the 70s that doesn't work, but in theory it measures the amount of electricity the eel is giving off. I was so into it.
Wow.
So I got to draw eels for Humboldt, and it's saying to me.
And I find it really fascinating that in addition to having so much nature in most of your works, all of them deal with the scientific past. So what do you think we can learn, Lillian, from studying the scientists of the past that's different from maybe just reading a science magazine or what's new in tech, right?
Personally, I mean, I kind of have to come from the Humboldt place to talk about this, but I think with other history, like political history, we have a lot of characters. Like in the States, we know about our founding fathers, and when you think about Thomas Jefferson, you can kind of see his face. So when you're talking about science and you're trying to teach science, you know, people did these experiments, and these theories have faces connected to them. And I think that kind of going into the history and cementing that scientific sort of baseline knowledge with these faces, it kind of reteaches those big complex ideas, and they get sort of broken down because you can become more familiar with them because you come from a place of story instead of just data. Mm-hmm. So for me, I think there's a lot of scientific stories to be told. They can be modern scientific stories, but I think that in order to tell those stories, we need to cover some big ones that haven't been covered, especially in comics before.
Yeah, and that's definitely true. I mean, I haven't had the opportunity to read about Darwin before this work, despite Darwin being probably one of the few scientists that, you know, you can name and you have a face to the name, even though it's not the young face, which is very interesting. Did that motivate you in exploring scientific figures of the past, Jeremy?
Ça veut dire que si le passé...
In the past, yeah. So why is it important to think about scientists of the past?
I don't know, because Darwin is controversial.
Controversial.
Controversial. I mean, it's been about 100 years and more that the origin of species was on book. And today we are... think about separation between the scientist and the religion. So I don't know if we can learn about the past or the past about Darwin, because I write about Darwin, and it's difficult to take the time to understand the past and the scientific past, and I don't know. It's hard because now we talk about ecology, and about 10 years or more we don't understand we have to change, and we think about the past, but we forget it really fast. So
those who do not study history are doomed to repeat it.
Yes.
Speaking of which, Ryan, you basically did a survey of all of our scientific past, which is really interesting. Did you have any major takeaways from studying it holistically?
So my big major takeaway, which I love because it's not a common major takeaway in a popular science book, is that we're not as clever as we think we are. Great. I found all these instances in history in which we had all the pieces we needed to invent something and didn't put them together in the right way for hundreds, sometimes thousands of years. The one that always comes to mind is the compass, where the ancient Greeks in 200 BCE are like, it's weird, some of these rocks stick together. Oh well, done with that. And then China, 1000 CE, invents the compass and uses it for fortune telling for 100 years, before anyone thinks, oh wait, we can navigate the entire world with this. And that's like over 1000 years where we could have had compasses and didn't. And the great part about that is that a compass now is like the tiny sliver of metal balanced on a pin sandwiched between two layers of plastic. You don't need that to make a compass. If you have a rock that's magnetic, you can tie that to a string, and the string lets the rock rotate freely, the rock points towards magnetic north. There's your compass. Tying a rock to a string took us over 1,000 years to figure out. And at first I was thinking, how embarrassing for humans, for compasses, buttons, pasteurization, hot air balloons, huge expanses of time that we could have had this and didn't have it. But then I thought, this is kind of an optimistic thing, because if there is a continued repetition throughout history of having pieces not put together in the right way, there's no reason to think that stops in 2019. And there might be something really cool that we have everything we need to invent right now and just haven't, smashed those two rocks together in the right way. So I think I'm really optimistic about that after seeing all the bloopers throughout human history.
Humanity's blooper reel.
Yes, they're pretty embarrassing.
Yeah. Well, I'm really keen to ask then, what's your theory of what the most boneheaded thing we're doing right now? What are we sitting on that could be the next greatest thing? What's your guess?
Oh, God. I mean, in terms of boneheaded, there's some fossil fuel stuff that could be done better. But in terms of what I think the future might look back on us and say, these idiots, have they not realized this? If you look at our bodies, we, shower often, have to vacuum our houses every couple weeks because there's just all this dead skin sloshing off our bodies and becoming organic dust in our houses. And if you look at that from a non-human perspective, that's gross. And we have all this stuff around it that we don't even notice. Of course you have to wash your face every day, otherwise you'd get gross stuff on it. And it feels like if we solved that problem technologically, we would look back at us right now and be like, how did they live like that? They were fossil. They owned robot vacuums because they were so dirty. It's just crazy.
Yeah, I always think back on how lucky I am to live in an era after the hot shower has been perfected, but before it's been banned for being an extraordinary luxury,
Showering in perfectly drinkable water.
It's insane. Yeah. Delivered in super hot
temperature.
Perfectly
drinkable water in our toilets. It's insane.
Yeah.
It's insane. So, you can drink in a toilet. It's fine.
Yeah.
Wait, don't take that out of context. Ryan says drink in a toilet.
Oh, we are being recorded.
Perfect.
Further to that, Lillian,
yes.
You mentioned that Humboldt was one of the first people to theorize, or at least try to evangelize, that humanity is having an impact on our natural systems. Mm-hmm. What do you hope the message is that people will take reading this book? What do you want for the future?
Well, a lot of people don't know that we've sort of known about this for as long as we have. I mean, I didn't know. I just hope that, if anything, people knowing that it's been going on for so long will maybe help convince a few other people that are hesitant about the ideas. But also, you know, Humboldt's whole thing was he wanted, you know, art to inspire action. So he really, you know, wanted to show people these environments that we were destroying with deforestation and irrigation. And, you know, if you can see the world, and if there's art about the world and the natural world, then I'm hoping that that sort of inspires more action, you know.
Wonderful. And then further to inspiring action, Jeremy, what do you think we can do as cartoonists, as people who are like comics, what can we do to inspire the next Darwin?
It's a hard question.
It's a tough one. Just solve it for us.
Thank you. I don't really know. With my books, comment dire, humblement. I don't know, but. Mm-hmm. I try to bring science and to children read book. When I'm in France, I live in Belgium, but when I'm in France, I make a conference with students or children, and they read books, my books, when I come. And I saw a lot of children who didn't read at all. So, in one time, I saw a children come to me and said, "This is the first time I read, and this is the first time I read the comics." And it was so so glad, so happy, and I was happy too. So, maybe if we can bring like this some people to read and know about people, scientists or other people. I think it's a good step. It's a good one. So,
yeah. Books are such a beautiful portal through which you can learn almost anything. Yeah. And it's Ryan, do you have any insight from your work in Adventure Time, like working for a much younger audience? Is there anything that you can glean from that experience?
Yeah, I've done some talks at libraries, and I always try to introduce this idea carefully, because I'm surrounded by librarians. But I have a slide that has a page of prose, like a page from a book, and then a page of Superman and Batman and Wonder Woman fighting this bad guy. And they're side by side, and everyone's eye turns towards the fight, the comic book, because it's a more intrinsic, like, reading is great, we all love reading, but comics is more fun than reading a book. I think it's an intrinsically fun medium, which is great for reluctant readers, people who are maybe struggling, because if you don't get the words, the pictures can give you some clues. If you're learning the language, it's great. And it's also great when you're talking about science or like technical concepts, you have two chances to understand it, the words and the pictures. And so I feel like as a medium for communication, for science communication, for outreach, and just for fun, it helps. It's like, you know, like a bad movie can also still be good, because watching a movie is inherently fun. I feel like reading comics is also inherently fun. And exploiting that when you're talking about stuff that could be challenging, I think it's great, because you get that for free just by working in the medium. You get a book that is slightly more fun than just text is.
Yeah, it's always an exciting experience. Like,
yeah.
Oh, a comic.
Yeah. No, it takes so long to make, and you can, you know, spend 2 years in a book and then read it in half an hour and you go, all right.
Fine, I guess. You also, I was really impressed with the way, Ryan, that you took very complex technical ideas and broke them down into first principles for a pretty broad audience. Mm-hmm. Can you speak a little bit at your approach to taking those very complex things and breaking them down?
It helps to be not super well-educated in those fields. So you have the questions of a beginner, like, well, how did... You know, we're trying to make a steam engine. Like, what is the steam doing? Like, how does this work? So I actually found the section of the book of your science the hardest part, because for me, it's all second nature. That's what I studied. And matters like you are. None of this makes sense. Complaining first principles, but when you don't know what it is and you're researching it to figure out how you can explain it, you get to ask those, you know, the stupid questions to yourself and be like, this is I don't understand water expands. How does this work? So it helped to not be good at it, have to explain it.
Mm. That's interesting. In Buddhism, they call that concept beginner's mind.
Beginner's mind. I have beginner's a mind. Big beginner's mind.
Yes. Lillian, in your book, Humboldt described how art was so important to him in describing these scientific concepts. The one that really stood out to me was the way that he illustrated isotherms. Mm-hmm. So before Humboldt's time, there were these huge tables of numbers, and correct me that I'm wrong, which described typical temperatures that you would find in that region. And Humboldt was the first one to basically visualize that data by drawing how the lines wrap around the world. And I found that was so inspiring.
Yeah.
What else did you learn about art and science from his work?
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, he was one of the first people to make infographics that were, like, you know, widely distributed. His books are actually not that rare because almost every library in the world had a copy of one of his books. And they're like very heavily illustrated. So I think it just really opened up my mind to how much illustration, I mean, how much illustration can help a person understand a scientific concept. And really looking back to my whole process on the book, I needed to draw out kind of what was happening before I could kind of panel it out, just because I needed to understand the scientific concept. And so, just like you said, I do not come from a scientific background at all. So I was really learning these things from 1 to 10, you know, and so it helps you teach when you're teaching yourself a lot. But yeah, having Humboldt's own illustrations helped me so much because it was, one, continuing that conversation between us, but it was also, thank God, I don't have to read this for 10 years. I can just look at this and read the accompanying text and understand what's happening in this graph. Yeah,
awesome. And Jeremy, something that really stood out to me in Audubon's book is that he was told his art of birds was too artistic to be science. Do you agree with that assessment?
At the time, no, because it's a mix between art and science. For the time, it was too artistic because all the shape of the birds were really in position, in movement, and the tradition was really academic, just in profile, and so it was really avant-gardist for its time, and this is why he had a really bad time to get published, because all the birds he painted was really, really impressive and artistic. But we have to know that Audubon didn't just paint the birds. He writes a lot about the birds, about their behavior. Yeah, their behavior, and he drew also the eggs about them. He collect the eggs and the nest. So he was scientific, but all the paints are really too artistic for the time. So
yeah, do you think there's something to be said about the difference between fine art and comics as it's viewed as a low art? Do you think it's do you think comics is too low art to approach these scientific concepts?
No,
no.
I don't think it's 90s art. So no, we can mix again like the painter of Audubon in the when he painted. So yeah. We can bring science and art together. It's a good mix.
Can I just add on to that?
Absolutely.
I think that comics are like the perfect medium for bringing science and art together, because they are a mixture of text and art. Mm-hmm. So you're not only learning through reading the text, you're also learning from what you gain from the image, and you're getting that immediately, and it's already a medium that's set up perfectly for that combination. So, I mean, I'm sure everyone agrees that.
Yeah. We're all in favor of confidence.
You know, like a chart doesn't look out of place, and adding that emotion into it, I feel as well.
Yes.
Like, yeah. Really helps bring science topics to life.
Exactly.
And Ryan, one thing that really strikes me about your work is you have such an infectious enthusiasm for anything that you're talking about. Do you think that plays a role in making science engaging?
Yeah, I mean, if you have a bored teacher, if they're boring, I feel like that enthusiastic voice started. I know it started with T-Rex in Dinosaur Comics. It actually started before that, where I was working and writing emails to coworkers, and I found if I ended with a period, it sounded very dour. Mm. Like, I don't know, I need that data, period. Well, I need that data, exclamation point, sounds like I really need that data. But I just, working with plain text, I found exclamation points made it seem more friendly. And then that led to T-Rex, and this voice when I'm writing, trying to explain something, where if you're enthusiastic and you're excited about it, you can find what's exciting about the text and about the subject matter and share that. It helps. I mean, my one rule of thumb of writing is if you're bored when you're writing, it's going to be boring when someone's reading it. So you always have to be your harshest critic when you're reading your work and be like, is this interesting? Am I enjoying myself? Can I make it better? Should there be more jokes?
I think that's really insightful. Did you find Humboldt's enthusiasm infectious?
Yes.
And do you think that may support his revival as a figure of interest?
Yeah, I mean, I think in the book we were very successful bringing the voice that's in the journals out into the drawn Humboldt. You know, he was a huge character to the point where, you know, he is the inspiration behind a lot of Jules Verne's writing. I mean, he was an adventurer and he was enthusiastic and he was kind of mean sometimes about it. He just wanted to study things and he didn't want anyone to get in the way, to the point where, I mean, he got pretty problematic. But he, you know, he comes across as not the best guy in the book, but I think because he's just so, like, get off your butt, it's science, you know? It pulls you through the story. So I think, if anything, it helps a lot kind of just get you through the parts where we do have to explain things.
Yeah. And Jeremy, like, the two narratives that you wrote were also extremely adventurous. Were you surprised at how much adventure was involved in the pursuit of science in that day?
Yeah. This is why we made the two books. Unfortunately, I don't understand why I'm here, because the two books are not about science, but it's about travel and a voyage. And we are going to make a third book about Robert Louis Stevenson, who is not a scientific, so it's about travel. But I didn't know John James Audubon before I made the books, and I realized just how he traveled and the way to understand birds and science about stay on the forest a long time, and the same about Darwin, who participated a lot in the research. He sent a lot of stuff in England, sorry, and so it's really impressed to see how they works before. So,
yeah.
And just a parenthèse.
Yeah.
Darwin was inspired by Humboldt. Mm-hmm. He was a very important person to him. He read his book, and this is why he traveled around the world.
Yeah, we have a whole page on Darwin in my book, if you like Darwin.
We have a page about Humboldt in my book.
It's so exciting. Yeah, no. It's so exciting when you encounter these scientific figures who were also contemporaries, mm-hmm. right? And sometimes I take a step back and I imagine how all the people that I'm working in science are also my contemporaries and how that might look in the future.
Yeah.
I had a question. Ryan, do you think that there's still adventure to be found in the pursuit of knowledge?
Oh, yeah. 100%.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember the first day of grad school, they were like, so, you know, you're in grad school, congratulations, but what you need to realize is you're going to learn more and more and more about a smaller and smaller and smaller subject. And the old joke is that eventually you will know everything about nothing, bring that to its limit. But the dean was like, you know, if you're very lucky, there will come a day, a couple years from now, well, you will learn something, you will discover something that nobody else on the planet knows yet. And I really hope you get to experience that. And I was like, holy crap, it's cool, it's cool. And so a couple years later, I learned that a certain measure of like verb acceptability was could be improved by 20%. That was a paper. But I feel like even if you're learning about, whatever you're learning about, when you're at that frontier of we don't know what's going to come out of this yet, it hasn't yet been done, that is inherently exciting. Even just sitting, running experiments on a computer, it's still fun to see what comes out of that. So I guess, like comics, science is an inherently fun medium. You have to do cool stuff in it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's so exciting, but I wanted to talk for a moment, you touched on it briefly, Lillian, about the flip side of that enthusiasm, and that excitement is borderline obsession. And we definitely saw Humboldt being very, very driven in his pursuit of knowledge, scaling volcanoes when maybe it wasn't the best idea to do it. Do you think that was essential to his character as a scientific figure?
I think it definitely was essential. We wouldn't have Humboldt's works if Humboldt hadn't gone out and done things that people weren't doing. You know, he climbed Chimborazo, which at the time was the tallest mountain in the world, to his knowledge, and, you know, he went to volcanoes, and he drank the water of every river he was on. You know, stuff that should have killed him. It's absolutely, I mean, he was a very sickly child. It's amazing he lived through it all. But, you know, he did what he did, and we got what we got out of it, but, you know, he also did horrible things. Like, he, you know, Chimborazo was, you know, he overstepped a lot with indigenous people. A lot. He stole from graveyards. And we include all that in the book because we know that it is part of his history. He also, on the flip side of that, it's a flip side of a flip side, he studied the languages and the customs of the indigenous people when other people were not doing that. They were going down there to enslave them. And he spoke out and wrote about the enslavement of indigenous people. So it's a very complex subject. The Humboldt and the indigenous people, was it good, was it bad, does it equal out, who knows? I don't feel like I can have an opinion on it, but what I can do is tell that story and include all of it in the book so you can form your own opinion.
Yeah. Did you experience the same kind of reservations with Audubon? Because he was not only a naturalist, but a very avid hunter. And
yeah, he's he killed about, sometimes he said, if I don't kill about 100 birds in a day, it's a bad day. So.
Oh, God.
It's difficult. We said that it was the time. They don't see about the extinction of birds. They don't realize, and it was the time of the industrialization and deforestation. Audubon's put things on it. They remark about it, but they don't really realize about that. He drew about 425 birds, and about in that, 7 are extinct completely. So they about passenger pigeon, they were about 1 billion of individuals, I don't know what to say, but they're all extinct in about 100 years. So it was difficult to talk about that, but it was a story. It was a part of the story. So.
Yeah. We have about 10 minutes left, so I want to ask one final question to wrap things up and then see if we have any questions from the audience. Ryan, you have a master's in comp sci.
Yes.
But do you think you need a science degree to make comics?
No. That's a funny story about that degree. When Hunnam and Everything came out, or was coming out, my editor was like, do you have any credentials we can add to your bio? And I was like, oh, shoot, I forgot. I have a master's of science, master's of science. And then it seemed like there's such a suspicious thing to forget. I dug out my degree and took a photograph of it and sent it to her 20 minutes later. And then I realized that's even more suspicious. Like, where were you last night? I was at home. Here's a picture of me on the couch. I'm so much of it. But yeah, like, I don't think you need a degree to do this stuff. It came in handy for the one little chapter of computers, but the rest of it was just learning it and sharing it. I was really sort of reluctant at the start to feel like who am I to write this? And I felt like every science communicator probably is an expert in that field. It's not the case. They're just good at talking about what they learned. And that was really freeing to realize that as long as you can, if you're interested in something and you like sharing what you've learned, you can communicate that and share it with people and write comics and write books about it. So I don't think you need any special training. I'm also not trained in writing, so just power through. You'll be fine.
And Jeremy, do you have any advice for someone who wants to get started illustrating science comics?
Oh. Just let it be and do what you want. And I don't know. You have to practice for a long time if you want to do scientific comics. But me, I meant just comics, not not scientific.
How about you, Lillian?
I mean, I always say I'm not necessarily a comics artist. I'm an illustrator, and what I've learned becoming an illustrator and looking at illustration is that if you are into something, get really into something and draw it a lot, and then you're an expert at it. That's illustration, you know? So just be a nerd and like really celebrate being a nerd, because that's the best way to do any job, really.
Alright. And are there any audience questions? Yes.
I am very into museums of all kinds, and I work at one here, and currently we have an exhibition about a dinosaur that some of our curators discovered, and the exhibition team made like comic characters out of the curators, and it's something I haven't seen really before, and I'm wondering what you all think about the interactivity of comics and museums or other places.
Okay, I will repeat the question for the benefit of everyone here. So if I may summarize your question, you really like attending museums, and you have noticed comics becoming a fixture in creating interactive museum exhibits. And what do the panelists think about bringing comics into other scientific spaces?
I'm for it.
Very for it.
Me too.
Like I said before, I think comics are fun. They catch your eye. When you see kids and adults at museums, they tend to, it's promising, they don't always read the descriptions, they look at the objects. But you'll look at a cartoon character, you'll look at comics. So it's a good way to provide a little more context. Which is good.
Can I say, I was, I'm from Boston, and the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum just recently did a Botticelli exhibit. It's not science, but they had comics alongside it that were an artist looking at the painting from another perspective, and the comic was literally from another perspective of the painting. It was the coolest exhibit. It was about 4 paintings total. The coolest exhibit I've seen possibly in my life. If you can find information about it, it's the Botticelli exhibit at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum. It does exactly this, and it's so cool. Yeah.
All right.
No.
All right. Any additional questions?
Is there a scientist or science that you think, scientists, will be the biggest challenge to try and in a comic form?
Okay, so the question was, is there a scientific figure that would be a huge challenge to make in a comic book form?
I would love to see... this is just a challenge that I kind of want to put out there, but I would love to see more comics about programming and how to sort of make visual a computer interaction. I think this might be your arena.
There's one called Secret Coders.
Yeah.
That does a lot of that really well. Mm-hmm. Sort of teaching you basic loop structures and decision structures through visual representation. So it exists.
Cool. Awesome.
I can also recommend the Crash Course series on computer science. I thought was quite good.
More things to buy. Nice.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's free on YouTube.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Is there anyone, Jeremy, that you'd be like keen to write about?
I don't know. Maybe something about space. Blacko, I guess Stephen Hawking. But it's really hard to interpret, to draw space, and first, before draw, to understand black hole and everything. So maybe it's a challenge to but yeah, mm-hmm. I think of us.
Yeah, so trying to illustrate some of these things that we don't have a lot of physical interaction with, right? Mm. Getting that onto the page in a way that's clear. Mm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Any more questions? You had one? I saw your hand up.
So one area that's been growing within the field, it might be in other fields as well, but I'm not sure, is the knowledge translation or knowledge mobilization. It goes under a number of different names. But basically the idea is, how do we take what we're finding
can comics play a role in knowledge transfer from either experts to laymen or between different fields?
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like part of the challenge is getting people to read it in the first place.
Yes, that is a huge thing.
Yeah, that's been my experience. We get a bunch of people like, I don't want to read. What's important here? And again, I feel like the funness of comics, if you have a bunch of documents and one page of comics, like, oh, well, see what this is about. So that can help for sure. Like, I feel like it's a very accessible medium, and it's a very non-threatening medium. A page of comics welcomes you, a page of text can push you away. So I feel like I'm in... Basically, any question that involves, should this be comics, I'm like, yeah, let's try it. Let's see what happens.
Have you either of you seen any instructional comics that you thought were handy, or...
I mean, the ones on airplanes.
Yeah, I like those too.
It's true. I mean, if you take the Scott McCloud interpretation, you find comics everywhere.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. I think we have time for one more question. Yeah. In the front.
Oh,
yeah.
I was curious if you, either any of you read popular science books by notable scientists like Einstein and Poincaré, whether those influenced the way you saw science. It's an interesting genre.
Yeah, okay. So the question was, have we read popular science books by famous scientists, and have they been an influence? All right. Have you, Lillian?
Personally, I've only read parts of Humboldt's work. It's, again, as an illustrator, you kind of have to scramble to put together the knowledge you need for any given page. So... I don't come from a science background, and reading scientific books hasn't been part of my regimen in the past, but I would be interested if someone said, oh, this could be something that you could draw. That I always come to nonfiction from a place of, I want to learn something about something that I'm going to draw, mostly.
Okay. Well, like Linia, I'm at, I don't read Humboldt, but Darwin. But yeah, I come from also from comic books and illustrator, so I'm really I read a lot of book of Jack London and not at all about science.
Okay.
Just origin of species.
I read Stephen Hawking's Brief History of Time when I was a teenager, and I was like, "You lost me, Steve." Make this more accessible. But for having everything, I read a lot of survival guides, because they're one of the problems of being stranded in the past is surviving that first couple weeks. And these weren't written by respectable scientists. Some of them were just written by crazy people. And one of them was a real publisher. And he was like, listen, after society collapses, you'll want to go into the cities and eat like canned food and dry goods. And the great thing about that is that food doesn't go bad, so it'll always be good, safe to eat. I was like, that doesn't sound right. So I turned the page, and was like, yeah, and you know, because if you think of it, like, when meat goes bad, that's just bacteria eating the meat. The meat itself is safe to eat. If you scrape the bacteria off, you're fine. Like, food going bad, expiry dates are a government conspiracy. Like, where is this going? And then the next page is like, update to the second edition. Like, so I got botulism. Eating some bad fish. So fish can go bad, but I still think that other stuff is safe. And I was like, why? Who is publishing this? So I've read some bad popular science books. That's part of that.
So the moral of the story is, respect expiration dates.
Yes.
I'd like to take a moment to thank everyone for coming to talk about science and comics, and especially thanks to our three wonderful panelists, Lillian Melcher, Jeremy Royer, and Ryan North. Everyone give them a round of applause.